Welcome to the UK Column viewers and listeners. Welcome back to No Smoke Without Fire, where Debbie Evans and myself, Brian Gerrish, are going to be having a look at the royal family, King Charles in particular. This is episode 3 of this particular series, and I'm very pleased to say we've had quite some interest from our viewers and listeners and some very interesting comments. One of the common ones is, I never knew that about the royal family. I never knew that about Charles. So, Debbie, welcome. It seems to me that this edition of No Smoke Without Fire has engaged with our audience.
Well, I'm very pleased to see that it's ignited. See what I did there? Ignited. Some interest, because, you know, I've learned so much through doing this research, and I'm continuing to learn and continuing to be surprised. So let's see what people think of what we found out this time. And like we've always said, Brian, everybody can make up their own minds. All we can do is just present the facts and present the evidence as we have it. And then everyone makes up, joins their own dots and finds their own truth.
Well, we're allowed to ask some questions, Debbie. I think questions are always extremely powerful, because you ask the right question and people answer it. The audience, people watching, listening in, answer the question in their own heads. Mm. But I'm going to say, don't be too shy, because you overwhelmingly have been doing the research into this. And we'll say to the audience this morning that just before we went live, we were having a little bit of a giggle, because even though some of this subject is very, very heavy, we know that we have to... We have to keep a little bit of a balance and a sense of humour. So we were having a bit of a joke before the camera started rolling. But we also thought it would be a good idea perhaps to kick off with a bit of video, because people are keen on video and it does get a lot of information across very quickly. What caught your eye, Debbie, in the video sense?
Well, quite a lot caught my eye. It's been a very busy time, hasn't it, for the royals? A lot of people asking a lot of questions. You know, as we're recording this, there's been the controversy over the Princess of Wales's photograph that she released for Mother's Day. The King has a diagnosis of cancer, so he's not making public appearances. So other members of the royal family are stepping in for him. But he has put out a Commonwealth message, and there was quite an interesting reaction from some of the public with regards to the Commonwealth message. But I feel, you know, when you get one of those gut feelings and you see bits of evidence and you think, oh, things are starting to fall into place. And I'm hearing the word Commonwealth a lot, and I think we're going to be hearing more about the Commonwealth in the future. But I see Commonwealth countries as perhaps being what I would describe as a soft target, if you like, for the agenda, or certainly for what the King has planned for the planet, seems to be centered around the Commonwealth, probably because that's very easily accessible to him. So, well, it was, Debbie, just very interesting listening to the Commonwealth speech yesterday.
Debbie, the Commonwealth, of course, also represents a very large number of people on the globe. I can't remember off the top of my head how many people we're talking about live within the Commonwealth, but it's not only a soft target, I agree with that, but you're also dealing with a huge number of people that come under the sphere of influence of the UK, and of course very much the royal family, because invariably they are still the royalty for many of the countries within the Commonwealth itself. And the other bit that just comes into my mind, sorry to push in straight away with this, but I didn't want to forget about it, was that many years ago Mike Robinson and I were looking at some documents out of the Parliament in Scotland, and what we discovered was was a very strange document. It was very simple. It was, but it was really a document from within the Scottish Parliament, which was expressing support for the Commonwealth. And we were a little bit surprised about this because the sense was that the growing SNP at that time was maybe hostile to things south of the border. But here was this document which seemed to be amazingly friendly to the Commonwealth. But then with it, we found another document, and it was basically saying which is the best route to, it didn't talk about global governance. There was another expression used. But if I say global governance, just to pin it down, that's my words, not in the document. It said, what is the best route for achieving this world framework? Is it the European Union or is it the Commonwealth? And I wished that we had taken a copy of that document on that particular day, because the next time it came into our heads was months later. And of course, when we went looking for it, it had gone. So I know that's just me, Brian, telling the audience what I saw. So it's anecdotal, really, but I assure the audience I'm telling the truth. And we were just fascinated to see unknown people north of the border looking at the Commonwealth as a possible stepping stone for something much bigger. So, Debbie, make of that what you like.
Well, I think you struck on something else there. Now, don't quote me, but I've got a feeling somewhere in the back of my brain. I think it's a third of the world's population are based in Commonwealth countries. So you're absolutely right. It's a huge amount of people to control or to have power over, and a lot of land. And I think we're going to see, when you say there's a choice, you know, Europe or the Commonwealth, I think as we go on, we'll see that the Commonwealth is probably where we're heading.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so back on the subject of videos, we've got a video to do with the Commonwealth.
Yes, well, only we're recording this a day after it was recorded by the King himself, who, of course, we know has got cancer diagnosis. So he couldn't be present in the celebrations, but he's put out a speech, and I think we've got a recording of it.
The 75th anniversary of the Commonwealth is a moment to reflect on the remarkable journey that our unique family of free and independent nations has made since 1949. Last year, the Bahamas celebrated its 50th anniversary of independence, as Grenada has this year, and Papua New Guinea will next year. Each of these milestones, and many others like them, represent the fulfillment of countless aspirations and the achievement of such remarkable potential. And the Commonwealth's growth, with new members continuing to join our family of nations, demonstrates clearly that whilst we may not all have a shared history, we have common ambitions for a better future, working together to build resilience and respond to global challenges. The Commonwealth family is strongest when we are connected through friendship. As I've said before, the Commonwealth is like the wiring of a house, and its people, our energy, and our ideas are the current that runs through those wires. Together and individually, we are strengthened by sharing perspectives and experiences, and by offering and borrowing the myriad ways we have each tackled the challenges of our time. This is true both at the level of nations and indeed at the local level. We recognize today that our diversity is our greatest strength. The Commonwealth represents a third of humanity from all regions of the world, with all the different experiences, knowledge, and aspirations that this brings. Wherever we live, we are united by the many challenges we face, whether it be climate change, the loss of nature, or the social and economic changes that new technologies are bringing. Our diversity means that these challenges affect us all differently, and that we experience their impacts in different ways. Their seriousness, however, is common to each one of us. All of this means that we must work together to understand each other's perspectives, including the inequalities and injustices which still resonate to this day. We must find ways of healing and to support each other to pursue solutions. I cannot say often enough that it is by coming together that we create the best chances to improve our world and the lives of people everywhere. Indeed, over the years, countless people across the Commonwealth have been inspired to form their own Commonwealth associations, from lawyers and accountants to business and trade networks, and many more besides. The work they do is absolutely vital, sharing professional knowledge, experience, and expertise across the continents for the betterment of each one of us. The Commonwealth, above all, retains a particular focus on our young people, who make up two-thirds of the entire Commonwealth population. Whether in Kenya or Malaysia, Vanuatu or Dominica, Malta or Canada, I never cease to be impressed by their creativity, innovative skills and hard work, often in the most challenging circumstances. Their energy is transforming approaches to development, technology, and preserving and restoring nature, and will, I hope, help to shape and safeguard our common future. Having recently celebrated my own 75th birthday, it warms my heart to reflect on the way the Commonwealth has been a constant throughout my own life, a precious source of strength, inspiration, and pride. In recent weeks, I have been most deeply touched by your wonderfully kind and thoughtful good wishes for my health, and in return, can only continue to serve you to the best of my ability throughout the Commonwealth. My belief in our shared endeavours and in the potential of our people remains as sure and strong as it has ever been. I have no doubt that we will continue to support one another across the Commonwealth as together we continue this vital journey.
Well, Debbie, I have not heard that clip in full before, and I found it absolutely fascinating. We had a little bit of discussion before the start of today's No Smoke Without Fire as to how long we'd let that clip run for. But I actually feel that watching the full 5 minutes clip is very, very informative. So he's heading for our common future. I just wonder who our really is.
Well, it's, as he said, it's a third of humanity, and it's two-thirds of that third are the young people. So he's targeting young people. And, you know, you look back and you think of the Duke of Edinburgh's award targeting young people, the Prince's Trust targeting young people, and you start to see, well, you know, was this a good-hearted gesture that came from all the right places with the right intentions, or was there another underlying reason? Has this always been targeting young people? Because I don't know if you, I didn't count, but the number of times he said common in that piece, in that speech, whether it was Commonwealth or common ambitions or a common love for the planet, he kept using the word common. But clearly this is a Commonwealth association where he's promoting young people, lawyers, accountants.
Yes,
it seems like this huge, great, big consortium business. You know, this is the Commonwealth is a big industry. It's a business.
Yeah, I found that, I picked up on that as well. I thought it very strange that the first profession he mentions as really doing something to help humanity are lawyers. And no general disrespect to people who are in the legal profession, but it's a pretty long shout, isn't it, to say that this is the profession that's going to be helping to save humanity. And then what else is his message for the young people? It's about fear, because he's talking about the seriousness of the situation facing the planet with climate change and the attack on the environment itself. So he's very subtly putting out a message of fear to two-thirds of the Commonwealth population, which is itself a third of the global population. That's some powerhouse, isn't it?
Yeah, he's putting pressure, a hell of a lot of pressure on young people. You know, he said that it was all about preserving and restoring nature. And this is for them to do. This is their job. This is what he's telling them to do. And then to use analogies, I found quite extraordinary. The fact that the Commonwealth family was like wiring a house, and we're the current that runs through the wires within the house. You know, this is, he's using analogy there as well. But this is not a stupid man. You know, a lot of people have said about Charles as Prince Charles, you know, he's a bit eccentric, and I'm not doubting that he is. He talks to plants, and I don't doubt that he does. But he's switched on. He's very astute. He's very well read. And he's a businessman, and he's had a mission for many, many years, and he's been accomplishing it, I think, very well. So I don't think that Prince Charles, now King Charles, is the eccentric kind of not so highly intelligent man that we've been led to believe. I think he's very switched on, and I think he knows exactly what he's doing.
Yes, he isn't Tim Nice but Dim, I think was the description.
No.
No, he's something very different. But I'm also going to say it seems to me that he's very switched on within his own frame of reference, because there's certainly things that he just does not want to engage in. So within his framework view of the world, he's very switched on, but he doesn't appear to be able to see the reality for a lot of people. You know, even in this country, people who are suffering, people who got problems with the churches, none of that he seems to see.
He doesn't care.
Yes, he doesn't care.
It's people say, you know, he's nobility, he's the king, he's not in tune with the people. Well, that's because he doesn't have to be. He doesn't particularly want to be either. So, you know, when you look at it in the cold light of day, you think, well, I mean, I don't know, Brian, but casting my mind back to all of those years that the Queen was on the throne, I never saw the British public en masse objecting or protesting. You heard about the odd protest every now and then, but you didn't hear about a lot of rumblings of discontent about the monarchy like we do now. And as you know, as he was giving that speech yesterday, there were protests going on and people chanting "Not my king," and there was drums and all sorts of protests going on that we didn't get to hear about on the mainstream media, of course.
Should we have a look at that, because this is UK column and we should show the audience this. So let's see some of this protest, because I think there's quite a lot of points to discuss about it. So it's a protest video. Sometimes you can hear what people are saying. Sometimes you can't, because the volume isn't there or it's all a bit muffled. But let's show it raw, as it were, and then we can have a chat about it for the audience.
Rose, which it costs you almost £300 million a year, not thousands, £1 million.
Find out why we don't enjoy it so much. Have a lovely afternoon, but we're here to get rid of the monarchy because it is wrong in principle, because it's a corrupt institution, and because it is bad for our democracy, which is why we are standing here saying he is not our king, and that instead of a coronation we need an election, instead of Charles we need a choice. And that's why we're going to be here, and we're going to be at every place that which King Charles goes to, asking him questions, demanding answers, asking him to take part in debate and answer his critics. And we're going to be asking him why he dodges inheritance tax, why he dodges income tax, why he's so secretive, why he throws his son under the bus but protects his brother. We're going to be asking him why he thinks he should be our head of state without a single vote cast. We're supposed to be a democracy. We should not have a king in 2023. We should have an election for our head of state. We're not arguing for a US system. We're arguing for a parliamentary republic. We're arguing for every man, woman, and child in this country to be treated as equals in law. And we're arguing for all of us to have the right both to vote for our head of state and to be our head of state if we so choose them.
Well, there we are. So, a couple of questions I'll throw at you. I don't expect necessarily an answer, but whenever I see people well organised in a protest with the T-shirts and the uniform banners, I always wonder who they are. So I don't know who the group in yellow is, but I'm very interested in them. And I also noticed in that protest there was a lot of drumming, and drumming was very much a feature when Extinction Rebellion was turning up, not only to protest as Extinction Rebellion, but they were particularly good at turning up in order to undermine other legitimate protests that were taking place, particularly in London. What's your take on the guys in yellow?
I think you make a very good point. We don't know who they are. We definitely don't know who they are. And their underlying motive and their intention, I don't know the answer to that either. But what I do know is listening to people on the street, what I hear from people on the street, from young people especially, who don't seem terribly engaged with monarchy, full stop, actually. They really don't seem to care or take much notice. So I don't see that the youngsters are being engaged, perhaps with William and the younger members of the royal, maybe. They'll encourage more young members of the population. I don't know. But I hear my generation, our generation, Brian, saying, not my king. He's not my king.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say that I've always been a monarchist. The royal family have always been there, and my mother was very much a monarchist. So I went to see the state opening of parliament and stuff. But now, would I have ever gone to something and said, not my queen? No, probably not. It's not until now that he's taken the throne and all of a sudden he really isn't my king. So I feel that they're reflecting, I think, a lot of what the public are feeling, but I'm not sure who they are. Does that make sense? Sorry, I've rambled a little bit there.
It absolutely makes sense. And personally, I feel this. A lot of people could be very critical about Queen Elizabeth, but if you say, okay, come up with the evidence showing, well, they might come up and say, well, she's immensely wealthy, and that's one certainty. But she had a calm dignity, and she did seem to have an ability to actually get on with people. Charles is completely different, and yeah, he's come onto the throne, and this furore has started. But just to be fair to the team in yellow, of course, they're saying he's not our king, and we didn't vote for him. And I think I'm right in saying that if we go back in English history, it was actually the case that the people, I'll qualify that, people, we're getting into people with some standing in society, did at least get a say who was going to become king or queen. They actually made a decision as to whether a person was suitable to be on the throne. But Charles was anointed and put on the throne without any real dialogue with the public. And that's the bit that I feel particularly uncomfortable about. So maybe their suggestion in that demonstration that people should have a say who becomes their king and queen, perhaps there's some real merit in that.
Well, I think if nothing else, anybody from outside the UK watching this now should know that King Charles is not loved by all of his citizens.
Yeah.
Far from it. There are many people in the United Kingdom who are saying he's not my king. And I find when I look around the Commonwealth, if you like, there's more love and more respect I see for the royal family outside of the UK. And I think that's an interesting dynamic, because I think people from overseas, they think that we are all, you know, staunch royalists, whereas actually that's not completely the picture.
And as you say that, Debbie, what comes into my head was the interview I did with a lady called Sam from Uganda. And in talking about things to do with the family courts and child stealing by the state, but she was talking about living in her own country and the image of UK that was portrayed in Uganda. And of course, one of the things we know is that the BBC in particular, which of course has got this audience, this huge global audience, is remarkably good at selling the message that everything is lovely in UK and what a wonderful royal family we have. So I wonder whether some of that feeling and loyalty, even love for the royal family that you see people in the Commonwealth expressing is a result of the propaganda that's been pushed into their own countries via the BBC and other royalty-aligned media outlets.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure. Because when we start to see what King Charles has been up to behind the scenes and what he's created for the Commonwealth, I'm hoping that people's perspectives change and people start to ask some very serious questions, because this doesn't just affect the United Kingdom, you know, potentially the globe, but for sure, everybody that's living in a Commonwealth country should take notice of what King Charles is doing.
Yeah. Well, and on that wonderful comment, I think that's time perhaps to get back into the narrative that you were delivering in the previous episode of No Smoke. And of course, you were showing all of the things that King Charles and Prince Charles, as he was, what the king was involved in. And the key topic that we really broke on at the end of the last episode was Terra Carta and the Sustainable Markets Initiative. For people who are still thinking, oh, well, he's just that nice man who's the king, let's get back into having a look at what he's into.
The sustainable initiatives. We've all heard of the sustainable goals. So the Sustainable Initiatives is this website that King Charles has got, but it's otherwise known as Terra Carta. So this was established at the World Economic Forum by Charles in 2020, and he was talking about a one planet. It's been discussed before through the One Planet Summit. You can see actually in the next slide what the then Prince of Wales said about his new Terra Carta. There's the quote there from him.
The Terra Carta offers the basis of a recovery plan that puts nature, people and planet at the heart of global value creation, one that will harness the precious, irreplaceable power of nature combined with the transformative innovation and resources of the private sector. He is talking about global value creation, and he's talking about the private sector. This is about stripping even more wealth out of the globe. This is not about people. He doesn't even put people first. Nature comes first.
Money. It's all about money. See, there we go again. This is the common theme. He's a businessman. This is a business. This Terra Carta is the trademark. And of course, if you think about Magna Carta, where the people came first, he's just kind of wiped that off the face of the planet, literally. And now he's installed Terra Carta and something else, which we'll come to in a minute, another Carta. But Terra Carta is the roadmap, if you like. Well, it is. It's the roadmap to what's coming down the line. And he says that this is going to promote an inclusive, equitable, prosperous and sustainable future for the sake of present and future generations. Well, I would say the generations of the nobility, the generations of the globalists, but not us, I don't think.
Terra Carta will serve as the guiding mandate for, this is the Prince of Wales, because it was written a while ago, Sustainable Markets Initiative. This is about markets. The Terra Carta aims to provide an integrated roadmap towards an inspiring, inclusive, equitable, prosperous and sustainable future for the sake of present and future generations, supporting the protection and restoration of a minimum of 30% biodiversity on land and below water by 2030 and 50% by 2050, encouraging coordination, cooperation and cohesion within corporate and public, private, philanthropic domains. And then it ends by saying that Terra Carta is to be a living document that will be reported on and updated annually. This will allow the Terra Carta to keep up with global progress, technology evolution, and a shifting investment landscape while seizing rapidly emerging opportunities developing around the world. This whole language, Debbie, you're absolutely right. This is corporate language, markets, developing opportunities. This is about taking more money out of the earth wherever it's possible.
Public, private, philanthropic, partnership, money, all back down to money. But, you know, what I thought was interesting was where it said supporting the protection. I mean, let this sink in because it's quite extraordinary. Supporting the protection and restoration of a minimum of 30% of biodiversity on land and below water by 2030. Now, that's a third, 30% of biodiversity by 2030. That's the Commonwealth, right? That's pretty much that's the same sort of land mass as the Commonwealth. But that's not good enough. He wants to return the earth to biodiversity. That's half the planet by 2050. I mean, that's enormous. And then you've got these seals that go with Terra Carta, and you can see the green one, which is Terra Carta. So that's the sustainable initiatives. And let's not forget, you know, we've got big players in Terra Carta. We've got people like Unilever, AstraZeneca, BP. We've got Bank America, Heathrow Airports, Ernst Young. They're all involved in Terra Carta. And then you've got Astra Carta. So you've got the crown on one side with butterflies and bees, king of the world, people and the planet, harmony and nature. And then on the right-hand side, you've got Astrocarta, where it says to care for the infinite wonders of the universe, and it's his crown. So is he saying there that he's king of the earth and king of the universe?
Well, if you ask me that question, my response is yes, he does. This is what I pick up from his whole initiative and his demeanor and what comes out of his mouth. Yes, he actually does believe that he's king of the earth. And to also believe he's king of space is just incredible. I mean, I'll throw this in deliberately. Is he saying he's king of heaven?
Well, I guess yes. You know, I can't see any other way. This is the question, though, isn't it, for everybody to answer. It's going to be everybody's own personal opinion. It's a difficult one. But yeah, I would say so. And this seal, that green seal that you saw, that's really important in the big scheme of things, because if you get awarded one of those, then it's like receiving, I guess, the Willy Wonka golden ticket through to the brave new world. And you can see there that that's just another company. Well, that's the SAP awarded Terra Carta seal for commitment to sustainability. So if your company is a green company and eco-friendly and agrees to the net zero, the climate agenda, etc., you get the green seal. And if you get the green seal or the black seal, then, you know, you're doing very well for yourself. Thank you for the future. You've pretty much got a guaranteed successful company. Yeah. And we've got companies, I mean, the sustainable initiative, restoring the planet to nature, and yet AstraZeneca, you know, you've got companies like AstraZeneca that are supporting this. So this is big business, and it even spans to America big time. And I was surprised to see that this press release came out from the White House last year, July the 10th, 2023. And President Biden, he was hosted by King Charles at Windsor. And a lot goes on at Windsor, because we were talking in the first episode of Green King about Windsor and Windsor House and the laity, and a lot goes on at Windsor. But President Biden went off to meet with the king and 23 philanthropists and financiers to discuss this whole net zero climate change with Charles.
Over recent months, I am watching more and more video clips, of course, of President Biden, who is stuttering and stumbling his way through public speeches and election gatherings. And it's quite clear that the man is absolutely past it and is not capable of making any coherent, common sense decision. And then my mind says, OK, well, if that's the case, why is Biden still in power? Well, he's still in power because having a nearly dribbling, incompetent president means that the real power base is hidden by him. It's the power base under him. So when you talk about July the 10th last year, 2023, when President Biden and a team of philanthropists were meeting up with Charles, Biden wasn't putting anything into the meeting. He was just there as the rather dozy figurehead. The powerhouse was the advisors that came with him, all the corporations that came in with him. And the last point I'll make is that at no stage of this development of Terra Carta, or the space odyssey, as I'm going to call it, did Charles talk to the people in UK. He didn't call a meeting with his subjects and say, look, this is what I think is important. This is what I intend to do. He went straight away to these all-powerful corporations, global companies, and then once he's developed the formula, he's dictating to his own subjects, and he's actually dictating to the poor people in the Commonwealth, because they're being deceived into believing that this is a wonderful man that's got their best interests at heart.
Yeah, absolutely. And for sure, he absolutely hasn't. I mean, at Windsor, Grant Shapps went along, John Kerry went along as well. And the whole idea with all of these philanthropists and these financiers, the whole idea was basically to kick it up a gear, to put your foot back down on the accelerator, literally to accelerate Terra Carta. And that's exactly what they were planning. And that's exactly what you've got in front of you now. And a lot of people, many people have heard of Terra Carta, but not many have heard of the Terra Carta Accelerator Fund, which is the document that's on screen now.
Right, so that's 100 million, but at the bottom it says the members of the Sustainable Markets Initiative's Financial Services Task Force have committed over $8.9 trillion to support the transition to net zero by 2030 or sooner. Well, of course, that deadline's failed. That's the good news. But these people magicked up $8.9 trillion. Meanwhile, in the Commonwealth, let's play Charlie's game. In the Commonwealth, we've got people with no fresh water who can't feed themselves, but we haven't got any money for them. This I'm going to say it, this man, to me, is a complete fraud. I can accept that he believes what he believes, but for him to claim that he's got the best interests of people in UK and the Commonwealth at heart, this is a fraudulent claim.
It's a rich fraud though, isn't it? I mean, yes. I take it back to money again.
Yeah. Okay.
No, it's gone back to money. In order to put the foot down on the accelerator with Terra Carta, he's had to make some adaptations. So he's employed a company called Pollination, a global climate and nature investment advisory firm. So they're going to be the general partner of the fund because they've got this funding goal of $125 million. And then they've also had to appoint a global law firm. You can see there, White and Case. So this is where the acceleration accelerates even more. And I just started to look into Pollination. And you can see there, Brian, that it's a specialist climate change investment and advisory firm.
Right. And it says our people are the key to unlocking change. I wondered whether White and Case, the law firm that he mentions, is why Charles, in his speech that we opened this No Smoke Without Fire episode, we showed the clip of him talking, and the first people he mentioned as helping this whole change and improvement and transition of the world were lawyers. So do you think maybe he had that firm White and Case in his head? So that was a little plug to the good job that his legal friends had done.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll come on to them in a minute. But before we get on to them, and I think it's relevant too to what you've just said, is that Pollination, which is a specialist climate change investment advisory firm, as we've just said, look down at the bottom there and you'll see that we're talking governments, businesses, public, private capital. So again, we're looking at this fusion of public-private partnership with philanthropists, but I just wanted to see, I mean, we will get, I promise you, we will come to the lawyers, but these are the kind of people that are running Pollination. You've got Tony O'Sullivan and Martin Wilder. And I mean, you know, they've got some pretty strong CVs there. You know, they've been around the block a little bit and you can see plenty of names that will pop out to you, like the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, ARENA. We've talked about them before. This is all net zero. But then you've got the Serpentine Gallery mentioned there. You've got these are people with a lot of money and a lot of power, and they're going to be controlling literally trillions of people. This Terra Carta Accelerator that's going to be led by those two individuals is is a very powerful organisation. I mean, you might want to read the quote out at the top that King Charles wrote about Terra Carta there again.
Okay, so Terra Carta offers the basis of a recovery plan that puts nature, people and the planet at the heart of global value creation, one that will harness the precious, irreplaceable power of nature combined with the transformative innovation and resources of the private sector. So that comment he was pushing out. But I'll just reinforce your comment on the two men involved with pollination, because Tony, what was the gentleman's name? Let me just call it up.
O'Sullivan,
that's right. If you have a look at his CV, merchant banker and involved with hedge funds. So, you know, if we look at the world, I mean, very recently, I did an interview with Justin Walker where we were talking about the Bradbury Pound. This is a, I encourage people to go and listen to that audio discussion. But what we were highlighting is how money is created and who creates the money. And what we essentially show very easily is the present system of money creation and the control of the monetary system is a fraudulent system. Charles leaps straight into bed. Now, we're obviously not saying that either of these gentlemen are doing anything wrong, but what we are saying is that there is a financial system in the world. Charles has jumped straight into bed with it as if it's all bona fide and has the best interests of the public at heart. I mean, for the whole of my life, which is getting longer, as it were, I haven't woken up in the morning thinking to myself, thank goodness for those international bankers that have really, you know, helped me on my journey through life. Or thank goodness for those hedge funds which are supporting the local hospice. Or thank goodness for the bankers who are really helping our medical system to survive. I'm not thinking that at all. What I'm actually thinking is these are the people who are milking every area of human existence. There's nothing that we produce or have or grow that these people don't come in and take their financial cut from. And Charles leaps straight into bed with them.
Of course, money, you know, and the two gentlemen that we've just highlighted, Tony O'Sullivan and Martin Wilder, you know, there's a big Australian theme going on there. So again, we've got the Commonwealth creeping in. We're going to see Canada in a bit creeping in. You can see where the Commonwealth is. None of it is for us. Let's just be clear about that. This isn't being done for our best interests at all, at all.
Yeah, we'll pause there.
Well, yeah, because it is breathtaking. And I mean, you know, we're only on part three. We've still got a long way to go. But I mean, let's just get into the Terra Carta accelerator a bit, because nobody is really talking about the accelerator. You know, accelerator is a powerful word, and this really is speeding things up big time.
Yeah, so it calls itself an accelerator program. It's building capability and capacity across early stage nature projects and companies. Nature, it's not to do with people. We've got a Terra Carta Accelerator Fund investing globally. And this is nature-based projects and nature tech companies to deliver commercial returns. So you're spot on, this is about money and making more money. And the Accelerator Initiative is a response to His Majesty King Charles III's challenge to the Sustainable Markets Initiative to develop 5 land-based and 5 water-based initiatives per year through to 2030. It's got 125 million in the pot, and then it talks about pollination. And then it says the aim is for the accelerator program to be launched in 2024. And they are going to be looking at proposals of people. And if anybody thinks that their local parish council is going to make a proposal to these boys, they best think again, because these are going to be proposals that come in through the global corporations, and there'll be proposals where those corporations see they can make most money. Sorry, getting a bit motivated here, Debbie, but we're really into this subject now.
Well, I think you're going to be even more into it when you see who said what on the next slide.
Well, of course, it's Mike Robinson's old friend, Mark Carnage, as he likes to call him. Mark Carney, as was governor of the Bank of England. But he comes in by saying that the scale and urgency of the climate challenge is clear. We need a step change. We must act. And then he's saying that 4 out of 5 of the top G20 companies now report on climate-reported business risks and opportunities. And these are powerful boys because they got combined balance sheet values of 120 trillion. Then he's on to COP25 with 630 institutional investors managing 37 trillion in assets. Momentum is building. We must bring together the right combination of ideas, skills and relationship to drive systemic change and capital flows. Pollination does that. So there you are. We're talking about huge sums of money in order to create even more money. And this is all going to be accelerated. And remember that Mark Carney, as Mike in particular, reported several times on UK column, the governor of the Bank of England, as he was, simply said that if companies do not adopt the green agenda, they will be punished. They will be forced out of business. So this isn't even something which these boys are going to bring in with a carrot to the world population as something to help them. No, this is about screwing every cent, every dime out of the global system to make more profit. And if you don't want to play, they're going to put you out of business and you can starve.
It's funny you say that, though, because if you go back to the previous slide, you'll see that actually what you've just said Mark Carney's actually said it, Brian.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't read
that. It's like in plain sight, right in front of your eyes. I'll let you read it out because it's exactly what you've just said.
Well, that's because I was scanning the small print, as it were, there. Yeah, so I completely went by the headline. If some companies' investors fail to adjust to this new world, they will fail to exist. Think about what this man is saying. You don't play our game, we're going to wipe you out. And of course, for some people, if you wipe their businesses out, you wipe their lives out. You wipe their ability to feed themselves. So I'm going to say, when I look at these documents, the language is often very measured and it sounds reasonable, but the instinct of the people putting this stuff together are killers.
Yeah, absolutely right. But you know, I'm not going to disappoint you, Brian, because
you never have, Debbie. I don't think you've ever disappointed the UK column with research that you've been doing.
Well, I do love to deep dive. I think people are starting to call me Deep Dive Debbie now. I know a couple of our doctor friends are anyway, but there's the legal firm. So yeah. There's White & Case, the King's legal firm, who's going to oversee the Terra Carta Accelerator.
Yeah, well, I don't need to say much about them. International law firm, a long history as a global firm. And they say they're uniquely placed to help our clients resolve their most complex legal challenges wherever they are. Now, they're not talking about people in the local town who've got a dispute between them. These are people talking about working alongside vast global corporations to help those corporations win whatever legal battle they need to win in order to make even more profit. That's what they're to do with, in my opinion.
Well, we know the King's interested in lawyers. We know the King's interested in bankers. We know the King's interested in charities. We know the King's interested in faith because money in all of those. I mean, you imagine, we've just mentioned a few little strands. You imagine the huge pot of money if you add all of those up together. But let's just look at another area, sustainable insurance, because I never knew that existed, but it clearly does. A United Nations Environment Programme, Brian.
Yes, a strategic approach where all activities in the insurance value chain, including interactions with stakeholders, are done in a responsible and forward-looking way by identifying, assessing, managing and monitoring risks and opportunities associated with the environmental, social and governance issues. Sustainable insurance aims to reduce risk, develop innovative solutions, improve business performance and contribute to environmental, social and economic sustainability. And then I say, well, no, it doesn't. Insurance is about making money out of fear. People are fearful that their houses are going to burn down and they're prepared to pay a lot of money per year in order to mitigate the risk should that happen. So this is insurance companies working alongside big firms. It's not to do with them looking after little people.
Oh, no. Perish the thought, looking after us, little people. You know, just to reinforce, really, that insurance is a big business when it comes to sustainable goals and sustainable development. And you can see there that you've got Net Zero Insurance Alliance, the Sustainable Insurance Facility of the Vulnerable 20 Group of Finance Ministers, the V20, a task force on nature-related financial disclosures. But it doesn't take long, does it, before it all comes back full circle to the king. So the king's got his sausage fingers in the insurance pie as well.
Yes, it's incredible, isn't it? Top insurers join Prince Charles to fight the climate crisis. Yeah, I'd love to know how. What are they actually doing? Because we don't believe in the climate crisis anyway, but what do they think they're doing? And it goes on, it talks about, there was a few mentioned there, Legal and General Alliance, Hiscox and AXA, and they've all pledged support. And they say that the Prince, what the Prince is doing is helping us convene and galvanise a whole of industry response. So this is where everything is drawn into a big network. And the moment you see private-public partnership initiatives, the moment you're talking about this sort of thing, what it's actually doing is dumbing down governance that's accountable. It disappears into a blob. You're not sure whether you're dealing with profit-making corporations or you're dealing with a think tank or you're dealing with the government. It's all in a sort of squidgy mass. And the agenda's driven through that opaque blob. This has been going on for years, but now this is on a global scale where they're calmly saying, well, we've got the odd $9 trillion to make this happen, $9 trillion.
Well, you know, you think about, you've got money, you've got insurance. What else do you need? Oh, weather. You need to have weather. You've got to have floods. You've got to have disasters because that's where you get the insurance coming into it. But then you can see there we've moved on now from Terra Carta Accelerator to Terra Carta Exchange. And when you see what's in the Terra Carta Exchange, and you can see Lloyd's and BP and the sponsors at the top there. But when you go and look at what the insurance market is like that King Charles has got his fingers into, look, I mean, I've only taken a tiny selection. These are just a few. But if you go onto the Terra Carta Exchange website, the amount of insurance companies and insurance insurers like Direct Line, massive companies, they're all involved. They're literally, it, as you said, it's a web, Brian. But it's only when you start to get to look into these documents that you can see how big they are. But I mean, the electric vehicle services, you know, we're going into electric cars. Well, we know what happens with electric cars. And sadly, a lot of them have been setting alight and they've been on fire. So you've got the electric vehicle services, we've got carbon offset insurance, you've got hydrogen insurance. I mean, hydrogen's meant to be the next big thing coming down the line. Green endorsements. And like I say, these are just four. These are just four that I've taken.
Right.
So there's another funding stream for the king, insurance.
Yeah, and the insurance can also be used as a weapon because, of course, for a lot of companies, a lot of businesses, a lot of professions, if you can't get the insurance, you can't actually trade, you can't function.
No.
So, and we know this in the legal world, that if they want to get at a barrister or get at a solicitor or a law firm, what happens is their insurance is withdrawn and then they can't practice. So insurers, very, very powerful. And another example I can give of that is the horrible case many years ago when there'd been some pretty vile child abuse in children's homes in North Wales. And when this came to light, it also emerged that the insurers of that local authority were telling elected members of the council what they could not, what they could or could not say in public, because if they said the wrong things, they could damage the council's defence, and that means they would have to pay out more money, and that money, that risk of payout, was covered by the insurance companies. So ultimately, the insurance companies, this did appear in public reports, the insurance company concerned was working in the background to close down the exposure of the abuse of the children because they were helping protect the risk of the council in future compensation payouts. So if anybody thinks, well, yeah, they're only insurance companies, no, these are very powerful and very dangerous companies because they withdraw their cover. You can shut down whole sections of industry and the public sector.
But if not just that, too, if you think about, you know, the direction of travel that we're going at the moment, everything's becoming digital. So if you're not compliant and you haven't got access to your app, to your phone or to whatever you need to get insurance, you're not going to get you're not even going to be able to access insurance, let alone get insurance. And if you're not compliant, or you haven't been doing what the government are telling you to do, you won't even be offered insurance. And let's face it, a lot of people in the world, but especially we're talking about the UK here, have got mortgages where they need buildings insurance. You need car insurance. So you're right. This is a very, very powerful sector and it could affect every single one of us. But what really concerns me, I think, more than anything, is when all of this goes digital, because then some of us are going to be locked out of all of the systems entirely.
Yeah. Well, let's have a look at England, because allegedly King Charles is supposed to have, you know, England within his kingdom. He's supposed to be concerned for us. But what's he doing with COP28 and nature?
This whole natural England thing, I mean, you know, we haven't even started on his connections with farming, with his younger life, when he was visiting, he was going off very quietly and he was learning about crofting in Scotland. He was going all over the place, actually, to learn about organic farming, which is why you can see what's going on with Highgrove and organic farming. But natural England, I think we've covered Natural England many times. Tony Juniper there, the chair of Natural England, we'll come on to him in a minute. But Natural England have been responsible for snatching farmland from tenant farmers that have been there for generations. And they've snatched land back and grabbed it, land grabs back, in order to rewild. And Tony Juniper has been at the heart of this, literally. And Tony Juniper is one of King Charles's closest allies, closest friends. In fact, they've co-written a number of books together, one of which is a book called Harmony, of which I've got a copy and I've read it. And you'll see that he calls it actually a new way of looking at our world. And it's co-written by the King, as he was then, the Prince of Wales, Tony Juniper, and Ian Skelly. And I would say, to be honest, that this is the blueprint for what we're seeing now. This whole worshipping nature, the environment, sustainability. He also talks in the book about transition towns, which is the, I guess, just before the 15-minute city concept was really launched, but transition towns and how many places down here in the southwest actually have been involved in that. Totnes, Falmouth, many places down here in Cornwall. So a very revealing book. And for anybody that hasn't read Harmony, like I say, it's very revealing. But he's a prolific author. You know, King Charles has just written another climate change book with the very same gentleman, Tony Juniper, again. So climate change with Lady Bird, I believe this one's coming out. So
yeah, I'll just add that we're not plugging Amazon and showing the book. That's just one of the places. But I've got a suspicion. Does King Charles do everything he does and write all these books? I think what happens is he has it's not even a ghost writer. He has a partner that does most of it, and then he puts the royal pen stroke in all the key expressions, or he edits the draft. That's how I think it works, because I don't think he's sat there with original stuff coming out of his own head.
Although he is very learned, and there's a lot of sacred geometry in the book, a lot of it, and he's very knowledgeable on it. He's studied a lot. So whilst I would say, yes, he's got other people to write and contribute to the book, I think a lot of it is actually penned by him. It's said that he works until midnight every night. He gets up very early in the morning. He doesn't stop for lunch. He's pretty much a workaholic, and he's obsessed, literally driven. He's written a lot of books. He's read a lot of books. And he says that, you know, he likes nothing more than to sit in one of his beautifully manicured gardens, often manicured by Miriam Rothschild, but that's for another no smoke. And he reads. So he is very well read, and he is very learned, and he's an intelligent man. He's a businessman, and he's got a lot of money at his hands, at his disposal.
Okay. I think, Debbie, we could manage another 10 minutes. I've said that. I'll see whether there's a shout from Stephanie that we can't do that. But I think we do another 10 minutes. And that's probably a good episode that we've done today. I know you're itching because you've got so much stuff to share with the audience. But I think it is good to be able to work through it and have some discussion about it, and, you know, to put some context into some of these things as opposed to just getting, you know, raw images through the screen. So I think the discussion is necessary, and you always add some really good points. So let's squeeze in 10 minutes and see where that takes us. But we are saying to the audience, there's tons more to come about this man and what he's really up to. So
let's give them a little taster, Brian. I mean, we haven't really looked at the investiture. We haven't looked at the farming that he's been doing so much of. There's his personal life, his friends, his associates. You know, these are all the things that I've been looking into. So there's a lot more to come, a lot more to come. But I noticed, let's go back to his book, because a climate change book for kids and Cambridge Zero. So there you've got the University of Cambridge supporting His Majesty, talking about the World Economic Forum as well there.
And it says His Majesty has been an environmental leader for over 50 years. This reiterates your point that if people think this man was just some sort of eccentric, sat in the background pontificating on the beauty of architecture or the right architecture, no, this man has been up for this game for a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's not done it alone, you know. And should we just touch on members of his family? Yeah, we'll just touch on members of family because he hasn't done it alone. And you have to think to yourself, well, who do you trust in your family, you know, that can bring in the money, that's got a good, maybe a good sociable personality, that likes to go out and about? I mean, he's got the perfect brother, hasn't he? Or did have, in Prince Andrew, who was known as, you know, very sociable, very gregarious, bit of the sales rep. I call him the sales rep of the royal family. And, you know, what was he doing as UK trade envoy that's going to be kept secret by the British government until 2065? We don't know. We don't know what Prince Andrew has been doing, but we do know that there has been, there's certainly a biographer that wants to write a book about Prince Andrew, and he submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to the Foreign Office, but got told that all the documents pertaining to Andrew's role as trade envoy were going to be kept secret until 2065. That's 105 years after Andrew's birth. So this is breaking with tradition completely. So we're never going to know what Prince Andrew was doing or where he was getting the money from or where the money was going. We'll never know. But of course, what we do know now is that Prince Andrew had a lot of dealings with Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. And there was a lot of money there too. So you have to ask yourself, what kind of money was going to the royal family? And then when it did go to the royal family, where was it going? Was Andrew collecting on behalf of his elder brother? I'm not saying that he was. I'm just throwing it out there for people to ask the question, because I don't know the answer. But what's interesting about Ghislaine Maxwell is we come back to the word terror again, Terra Mar, because she founded the Terra Mar project in 2012 for the conservation of the seas. And you've just seen in the Terra Carta that the then Prince of Wales, now King, wants to return 30% of the ocean, 30% of the land, back to biodiversity. And the Maxwells were pouring a lot of money into it. And I went into Company's House to look at Terra Mar. Obviously, since the arrest of and the imprisonment of Ghislaine Maxwell, it has been dissolved. But there you can see the Company's House entry for it. So you just, the thing is, when you start to do a bit of research and you start to look at things, you end up with more questions than you do answers. And you think, well, where is all this money coming from? Was Prince Andrew fundraising for his brother's empire, this sustainable initiatives, Terra Carta, Astra Carta? Is Charles the saviour of the world? I don't know.
That's a good place to end on, Debbie. Let's just put the picture up on screen so that people know what we're talking about. Apologise for using a BBC image here, but Prince Charles, the winged hero, he's the winged hero saving the world, and he's going to become the centrepiece as a giant bronze statue of a remote Amazonian town. And he was actually shown a picture of this before it was produced and asked whether he was happy with it. And he said, yes. So it's Prince Charles with what? The wings of an angel.
We've actually got some more pictures. Maybe we'll come on to the pictures in detail next time. But what was said about this? Mauricio Bentes, which was the sculptor who sculpted this angelic statue of Charles. And it's his face, you know, when you look at it, it is him, it is his face. And when you see the whole statue, you see these massive wings, and then he's got a loincloth on, and he's standing or overarching a hill that's covered in skulls. And he dominates it, you know, it's extraordinary. So one of these statues has been erected in the rainforest. One was presented to him, a small one was presented to him by the sculptor, and he was extremely pleased to receive it, by the way, and delighted with it. And then Tim Cohen, who's done a lot of work on Charles and the history behind King Charles, he's heard that there is a life-size or even bigger, 10 cubits, I think, is the size, another one that's meant to be being put on top of the third temple if it's erected in Israel. So I'm just saying what I've heard and I'm just repeating what I've seen. But again, who knows, Brian? Is he the saviour of the world? Or does he think he's the saviour of the world? I think he thinks he's
the saviour of the world, but I don't think he's the saviour of the world. Debbie, let's end there. It's been a fascinating chat through just part of the information that you've assembled to do with King Charles III and the royal family. I'm going to say to the audience, thank you very much for joining us. Don't be shy. If you've got comments, you've got information, or you've got things that you think that we should, Debbie and I should be interested in, then get in touch, email it through. And also we'd say to you, please also give us feedback on what we're doing. Do you think it's important? Is the subject important? We'd really like to know, not only from UK Column members, whether we're hitting the spot, but we'd also like to know from people who aren't yet UK Column members, whether what we're saying is important for the not only the people in UK, but obviously people people worldwide. You need to understand what this man is really up to and what's coming down the pipeline. Debbie,
there's more.
Yeah, let's end there. Thank you very much for that contribution. Thank you very much to everybody who's joined us today for this episode. And do give us that feedback because that helps us enormously see whether we're hitting the right spot. So we'll leave it there. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.